Omaha Public Radio, KIOS-FM, presents another program from the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce. We'll hear the keynote address given at the Chamber of Commerce's 2007 Economic Outlook Luncheon. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Tuesday, November 20th, 2007, for broadcast at this time. The guest speaker will be Barry Asmus, Senior Economist at the National Center for Policy Analysis. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Omaha Public Radio, the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Stephanie Moline, Executive Vice President of First National Bank of Omaha.
Dr. Barry Asmus is a senior economist for the National Center for Policy Analysis. He was recently named by USA Today as one of the five most requested speakers in the United States. Dr. Asmus has been a professor of economics for 15 years and has twice been voted the Outstanding University Educator. Additionally, he is a recipient of the Freedoms Foundation Award at Valley Forge in Private Enterprise Education. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Barry Asmus.
Well, thank you, Omaha Chamber of Commerce, for putting on this fabulous lunch. I just feel so blessed that I get to come and be a little part of this. I just feel such a joy when I come to Omaha. I was born in eastern Colorado, and I know Colorado is a dirty word right now because the Cornhuskers will be playing Colorado this week, and so that's too bad. But it is. It's always fun to come to Nebraska, and I have great memories. My parents had lots of friends in Lincoln and in Omaha, and then luckily we had some friends in Broken Bow, Nebraska, and we did a lot of pheasant hunting back through the years, so it's just great being here, and I really thank the Chamber of Commerce for all that you've done. I mean, I just think a lunch to listen to an economist, I mean, it's just too much. Economists are so negative. They've predicted 8 of the last 3 recessions. I'm convinced that most economists choose to become economists because they do not have the personality to become an accountant. Sorry to Deloitte. Oh, jeez. Yeah, and I do want to thank very much to Baird Holmes and D.A. Davidson and First National Bank, and obviously Deloitte. I've already told a joke on economists, and so trust me, everyone will be offended by the time I'm done. I hope not. You remember the story of Tom Osborne in the middle of an Oklahoma-Nebraska football game calling a timeout, and the referee says, "What's the problem, coach? What's the problem, coach?" Look up there in the 99th row, there's an empty seat, and the referee looks up there and says, "Well, there is. Well, timeout." So Osborne makes his way up and comes across the row and gets there, and yep, there's an empty seat. And says the lady, said, "Ma'am, I see there's an empty seat." And she says, "Yes, it's my deceased husband." And he's, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I am so sorry. But couldn't maybe one of the relatives been here to take that seat?" She said, "Well, they could have been, but they're all at the funeral." The essence kind of my talk today is the good news is the bad news is wrong, and so let's start right there with the Cornhuskers. The good news is the bad news is wrong. Nobody is very happy about a 5-6 season, and so in fact, Cornhuskers are not even happy with an 8-2 season, much less a 5-6. So there's some real unhappiness. But you know, and I know in my heart, this is only a bad patch in the road. We all have programs that have a few problem years. Nebraska might be in one of those right now, but you know. And I know that the Cornhuskers will be back, one of the premier football programs in the United States. And so it's always painful to see when these moments happen. But as the prayer that was given before we all had this lunch, sometimes trials, tribulations, and adversity are our greatest friends. And so don't tell that to a Cornhusker right now, but we'll just have to take it that you meant well. And I think you're exactly right when you said that. The bad news in the country, everybody knows, we're not going to go over it. I mean, obviously, high oil prices. And no one likes high oil prices now. As a matter of fact, see, business expansions do not die. Business expansions are assassinated. And high oil prices are a real nice assassinator. So it's a possibility, definitely a possibility, that high oil prices could bring this economy to its knees. Probably not, but it could. But there is a good news part of $100 a barrel oil. When oil is $80, $90, $100 a barrel, every alternative is viable. When oil is $35 a barrel, no energy source, other source, is viable and can compare to oil. So in a sense, this is good news, bad news. And the good news is all these other possibilities will take place. If you and I could get in an airplane today, and we'd all fly to Detroit, and then we'd all get in a bus, and we'd go to Troy, Michigan, and we'd all go in there to see Stanley Oshinsky's factories. He's got six of them, and he employs 1,400 chemical engineers, all busy with amorphous silicon. What's amorphous silicon? Amorphous silicon is something you put in the roofing material, photovoltaically converts sunlight to electricity. You plug in to a nickel metal hydride battery at night, and your car gets all loaded up with energy, and then you go out and drive all the next day, and next day you do the same thing. Now, this is not a dream. This is reality. This is today. But I want to tell you, at $35 a barrel of oil, forget amorphous silicon. At $100 a barrel of oil, it is eminently possible, doable, and will be just one of the thousands and thousands of alternatives that will begin to turn up as we continue to experience to compete with oil, as we continue to experience $100 a barrel oil. So even $100 a barrel oil has a bit of a silver lining on it. The subprime mortgage, obviously, a pain. Obviously, I don't criticize, as you'll hear me talk about Alan Greenspan in a very positive way. I'm not going to criticize Alan Greenspan and start taking shots after the fact, but I think even he would admit that to keep the federal funds rate at 1% for an extra year, as he did, was an extra year too many. And we just simply had such low rates that this can cause all kinds of devilish things, none the least to say the subprime mortgage crisis. So I wrote a little poem. I might have to look here because I've never given this poem before. There once was a man named Farrell who bought subprime homes by the barrel because his stockbroker said fixed rates were a joker. Three guesses why Farrell lynched Merrill. Well, I'm telling you, there can be a time that we can be irrationally exuberant, and that period happens. And we went from 65% of America owning their own homes to 70% of America owning their own homes. And a good part of that portion were people that did not have good credit records and did not really have income to justify those homes. But homes were rising at such a rate that people were making promises. Gee, we'll buy you, get you that home, nothing down, no credit record. In 5 months, we can flip that home and give you even $25,000 cash. Well, what person wouldn't want to get in on that kind of a bandwagon? My point, we've got about 2 million of those contracts yet to be refinanced. So we will see some pain yet, and that subprime obviously is pouring into the other interest rate markets because all those loans are securitized and therefore bleed into the other markets. So business expansions don't die. They're assassinated. Could subprime do it? Yes. Will subprime do it? Probably not. Why? Housing is about 5% of the U.S. economy. Why? We're a $13.5 trillion economy. And so is it serious? Yes. Plop on top of that $100 barrel of oil, is that serious? Yes, it is. So are our stomachs just a little bit tighter now than they have been for the last 25 years? Indeed, they are. But it's nothing as compared to what it could be. And in fact, I'm going to share with you that I think the best is yet to come and why this is going to be a very, very strong business expansion with a little bit of a downtime, obviously, in 2008. Let me begin to say that Omaha is the poster child for what I'm really talking about. Omaha, a $35 billion economy to itself. Omaha, an unemployment rate that has been below the national unemployment rate for 40 straight years. Omaha making great, great investments right now, which will definitely spring into all kinds of jobs that we will see over the next years. Omaha, even as we compare year on year, we saw in this magazine, 4% increase in retail sales over a year ago, 2% higher employment than a year ago, blah, blah, blah. So there's just one good statistic after another. And when you figure a cost of living, which I think is kind of the most powerful thing in the whole magazine, is when you figure cost of living into this, Omaha, on a household income, the second highest in the nation when you start figuring about our cost of living. So Omaha truly is a poster child. This does not happen by accident. This happens because you have some people in the newspaper industry that are interested in Omaha and making it go. You have some people who are called mayors who say, I'm in partnership with you. You have some people called the Omaha Chamber of Commerce and Deloitte and all the sponsors of this. And it takes team to beat the world. And so you are to be very much envied in the sense of some of the cities that I see as I get to travel across the United States. I mean, I think line by line, Omaha has as good a picture as almost anything I've seen. So it's just wonderful to come here this time with you and share with you what I consider to be the six unstoppable trends and why this will be a very, very strong business expansion. So I'm going to have to go fast. I usually need an hour or two to go through the six unstoppable trends, and I've now got 18 minutes. And so I got to really let it rip. So I'm going to goose it up a little bit and talk just a little bit faster and faster. Here we go. Unstoppable trend number one, demographics, population growth. It is what it is. There's nothing we can do about it. Only to say that in America, pretty darn good. That is to say, we have 75 million people between the ages of 40 and 60 years old, 75 million people in a high productive, high consumption, high investment stage of their lives. So we look at our demographics, compare that to Western Europe and many other places in the world, our demographics looks good. Our population growth looks good, as does Omaha, by the way. But our population growth nationwide looks good. We're 300 million people now. We're heading to 400 million people by the end of the century. That'll be about a 30-35% population growth. I only mention that because countries that don't have that, you have some real serious problems. For example, Western Europe, 30 years has been in a population implosion. Western Europe is not replacing itself. Demographers are saying this about Western Europe, that they've never seen anything like this since the Black Plague of the 14th century. So I'm telling you, this is not very pretty as Western Europe continues not to replace itself. Neither does Japan. Japan has been in a population implosion for 30 years also. Russia is losing 2,000 people a day. What is the definition of a Soviet string quartet? The definition of a Soviet string quartet is what is left of the Moscow Symphony after they've traveled the United States. So they come over with a symphony, and they go home with a string quartet. So I want to say about demographics and population is ours looks very, very good as we look to the future. Positive sign number one. Number two. Friends, you have to have stable price level. Why? The language of an economic system, prices, wages, interest rates, profits and losses. This is the signaling system. And the problem with inflation affects the signaling system, and the signaling system becomes incorrect. Inflation is like a country where nobody speaks the truth. Inflation does to the economy what amphetamines do to the body. So it's bad, bad news. What's the point? We've had a 25-year business expansion. What's the point? We've had a stable price level for almost 25 years. Why have we had a stable price level for almost 25 years? Because we've had good monetary policy. As Milton Friedman, who is the key teacher of Paul Volcker, Milton Friedman, the key teacher of Alan Greenspan, Milton Friedman, the key teacher of Ben Bernanke, both Volcker and Bernanke, when Friedman died a few months ago, called him the greatest economist of the 20th century. And of course, Alan Greenspan was in a study group with Milton Friedman in the 1950s in Manhattan, Manhattan, New York. It was Milton Friedman, Alan Greenspan, Ayn Rand, Frank Knight, Murray Rothbard, et cetera, et cetera. So they're in a study group. But so they sit at the feet of this great monetarist, a man who told us that inflation is a monetary phenomena, a man who told us that it has all to do with the money supply, and a man who said, when is the Federal Reserve System finally going to be inflation targeters and leave all the rest of that other nonsense to the side? And so Volcker was an inflation targeter. Greenspan was an inflation targeter. Bernanke's going to be an inflation targeter. That's exactly what the Federal Reserve System has done. Point. Nice, stable price level of the last 25 years, which sets the stage for prosperity. Understand that inflation is another great assassinator. 6 times in the 20th century, Argentina buckled in half. 5 times in the 20th century, Brazil brought to its knees. But our think tank monitors 165 countries throughout the world, and I could tell you story after story in the 20th century about what inflation does to countries. Point, we've had good monetary policy, stable price level. Can we expect in the future? I believe so. Because we're not only going to be helped, I think, with good monetary policy, but with another thing called digital deflation. Now, digital deflation is a good kind of deflation. Better, faster, cheaper, smaller. Everything that the digital economy touches is driving prices down. That's good. Digital deflation. That is a good kind of deflation. And then obviously competition is good, driving prices down. So with good monetary policy, with digital deflation, and with lots of competition for goods and services throughout the world, we will probably look at a fairly stable price level as we look into the future, a critical point if it really becomes reality that we really do have a stable price level. So that would be unstoppable trend number two. That's very important, stable price level. Number three, taxes. Taxes matter. Taxes have always mattered. Ladies and gentlemen, perhaps you haven't ever thought about it, but do you realize that the United States had 5 back-to-back decades in a row that were lousy? The 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s. Who can imagine it? But it was true. 5 lousy, stinky decades where we had inflation and unemployment and every problem. You could go through each of those decades to just look at the 70s. The 70s, high inflation, high unemployment, $70 a barrel oil when oil was twice as important to the economy. Russia was taking over the world, blah, 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 blah. The 70s stunk it up. Listen to this. January 1 of 1970, the stock market 700. 10 years later, the stock market is still 700. All right. You mean it went a whole decade and moved a point? Yes. Excuse me. I mean, imagine that. That's the 1970s. Well, I'm not going to talk about the 60s and the 50s and the 40s and 30s. We had 5 lousy decades in a row. Oh, what else, though, characterized those 5 decades? Hello, a 70% marginal tax rate. You're kidding me. No, I'm not kidding you. Hoover and Roosevelt got it all going. Eisenhower in the 50s refused to lower taxes. We got a little tax relief under John Kennedy from 70 down to 62%. Woo! But by and large, 70% in the 60s, and then in the 1970s, a 70%. So if you explain these 5 lousy decades, I think it has to do with inflation rates and high marginal tax rates. Then on December 6th of 1980, a new sheriff comes to town. The new sheriff comes and says, Listen, I'm not an economist, Ronald Reagan says. Listen, I don't understand the economy. I don't understand how the economy works. I'm a B-grade actor from Los Angeles. Come on. But my head, my heart, my stomach tells me there's something fundamentally wrong with a 70% marginal tax rate. He lowers it from 70 to 50 to 28%. Now, ladies and gentlemen, in my opinion, the two most important events, economic events, in the 20th century were, number one, that the Federal Reserve System becomes inflation targeters, as the Chicago School of Monetary Economics has been teaching for the last 60 years, and they finally grew up, and we've finally been doing it, and Treasury people throughout the world are becoming inflation targeters. So that would be point number one. But point number two, lower marginal tax rates, 70, 50, 28. That's why we had this 25-year business expansion, because taxes matter. Taxes matter. Ireland goes from the poorest country in Western Europe in 1988 to today the richest country in Western Europe. How did Ireland do that? Thank you for asking. Meet with Prime Minister Charles Haughey and say, Prime Minister, the problem with Ireland, marginal tax rates are too high, corporate taxes are too high, da-da-da-da-da-da, and what you got to do is lower the corporate tax rate from 32 to 15%. I can't lower the corporate tax rate from 32 to 50%. Ireland won't raise any revenue. Prime Minister, sit down, have another beer, let's relax. Now listen, Prime Minister, you've got to get this next point. Prime Minister, 15% of this is a lot bigger number than 32% of this. So if you lower corporate tax rates, you will increase tax revenues. Oh, that cannot be. Prime Minister, excuse me. Ronald Reagan is just now ready to leave office. He's just ready to leave office. He's been in 8 years. He lowered the marginal tax rate from 70 to 50 to 28%. Federal tax revenues were $500 billion in 1981. Federal tax revenues were $1 trillion in 1988. That is to say, they doubled. You mean federal tax revenues doubled in the 8 years that Reagan was in office? Yes. By lowering taxes, you got it, pal. You got it. Well, Prime Minister Charles Haughey lowers the corporate tax rate from 32 to 15%, and the rest is an economic miracle. They're the richest country in Western Europe. I mean, one out of every three American dollars anchored in Western Europe is anchored in Dublin. Yes. I wonder why. Oh, no, I don't want to anchor in Dublin. I want to anchor in Paris. I like the cuisine. I like the food. I like the architecture. I've often wondered what it would be like to fight a war without the French. Well, much like going hunting without your accordion. I've thought, how many French would it take to defend Paris? We don't know. Paris has never been defended. But anyway, but to be quite honest with you, the jokes on France are about over. They elected a man president of France by the name of Sarkozy. Listen to this. He runs on the policy of, I like America. How's that for you? That'll really get votes in France, won't it? Won't it? Well, he won the presidency. Angela Merkel of Germany, another supply sider. Sarkozy and Merkel are going to turn those two countries upside down. There is a supply side revolution going on in Western Europe, and it's not only led by Merkel of Germany and Sarkozy of France, but it's mainly those Eastern European countries. When I first went into Romania 8.5 years ago, to the year 2000, Romania had an 80% marginal tax rate. Now it has a 15% flat tax, as does Czech Republic, as does Slovakia, as does Ukraine, as does blah, 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 blah. They're leading a supply-side revolution in Eastern Europe that's really affecting Western Europe. Point. Taxes matter. Taxes matter. I mean, I was having a sandwich on an airplane. It was a terrible sandwich. You wouldn't have eaten either. I didn't like it. I was so hungry. I just kept eating and eating, saying, if it's a cardboard box, I don't care. I'm going to keep eating. And the guy next to me complains, moans, groans, rings the flight attendant. She comes over. She says, may I help you, sir? Yes. He hands his whole plate up to her and says, this is a bad sandwich. She grabbed the plate. Bad sandwich. Bad sandwich. And she hands it back to him and says, enjoy. Well, I would like to take those five decades and say, bad decades, bad decades. But for our youngsters, my gosh, a 25-year business expansion that started in 1982, our young ones just haven't had to experience anything close to the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, and the 1970s. Inflation targeting, lower marginal tax rates. Taxes matter. Number four, productivity matters. Really matters. There are those that like to make us believe, jobs, jobs, jobs. It's all about jobs. Ladies and gentlemen, the U.S. economy is not about jobs. I'm not saying jobs aren't important. They're critical. but not about jobs. It's about productivity. If the economy was about jobs, let's get rid of all caterpillars, let's get rid of all earthworms, let's get everybody a shovel, and we'll build our roads and build our buildings with shovels. Now, everybody's got a job. And if by chance that doesn't get everybody employed, let's recall the shovels and give everybody a teaspoon. No, no, no. It's not about jobs. It's about productivity. Why is America so productive? Well, Cyrus McCormick comes into the field in 1836 with his McCormick Reaper. On that day, that one piece of machinery replaces 15 men. That one piece of machinery could do the work of 15 men. Today, all through the fields in Nebraska, you look out and you see a 35-foot John Deere self-propelled combine. That one John Deere self-propelled combine will do the work of 20,000 men. So if it's really about jobs, let's all make our way to Iowa and Illinois to the John Deere factory, each of us with a little hand grenade. When you walk by your combine, throw it in. Blow that combine to smithereens, and now we can get 20,000 men out in the field knocking it down with a sigh. Excuse me. It's not about jobs. Now, friends, we have to understand that 100 years ago, 60 million of us were in agriculture, including myself. I was born and raised on an eastern Colorado farm. 60 million of us were in agriculture. Today, 2.5 million. That 2.5 million people feed all of us, plus a good part of the rest of the world. Some of the reason is the cow, corn. Some of the reason is a John Deere self-propelled combine. Of course, we're very, very productive. In the same way, in manufacturing. Oh, no. We're losing jobs in manufacturing. No kidding, Lone Ranger. Listen, here's what's going to happen. 30 years ago, we had 30% of our labor force was employed in manufacturing. Today, 9% of our labor force is in manufacturing. And in the future, it'll be 8765432. In fact, we will reach the time when the average factory will only have two employees. Only two in the whole factory, a man and a dog. The man will be there to feed the dog. The dog will be there to make sure the man doesn't touch the machinery. That's the world we're going to. So we can dream all we want of getting Barry back to the eastern Colorado farm. Let's get 60 men. See, if it's all about jobs, let's get me back on the farm. If it's all about jobs, let's get people back in the factories in manufacturing. Life isn't going to work that way. As long as there is scarcity, there will always be jobs. So productivity is key. And let's just put the summary statement on American productivity. Productivity of the American labor force was going up 1.5% a year for 95 years. From 1900 through 1995, 1.5% a year. In the last 15 years, 3%, 4%. What have I just said? We've doubled the productivity of the American labor force. Is this a big deal? Thanks for asking. Yes, it is a big deal. In 1990, everybody was saying Japan. Japan, Japan, Japan. Japan's going to own the world. They have the 10 largest banks. Holy smokes, now they bought the Empire State Building. Oh my gosh, they bought Pebble Beach. Oh my gosh, the world is coming to an end. Japan, Japan, Japan. All right. Let's look at Japan, 1990, right up to today. 1990, $4.5 trillion GDP. Today, $4.5 trillion GDP. You mean Japan hasn't grown at all in 17 years? Bingo. How about the United States? $5 trillion GDP in 1990. Today, $13.5 trillion. It's so fun to get in an airplane. What do you do? I'm an economist. Oh, good. I've been wanting to ask an economist this question. When's it all going to sink? We're falling fast. When's it all over for America? I say, sir or ma'am, I just want to make three quick points, and then I want you to respond. Point number one, the United States has less than 4% of the world's population, and we're producing 1/3 of the world's wealth. Gross world product this year will be about $38 trillion. The United States is going to produce about $13.5 trillion. trillion, the United States produces one-third of the world's wealth. Secondly, with less than 4.5% of the world's population, we produce 80% of the world's Nobel laureates. With less than 4.5% of the world's population, we produce 90 of the 100 most important inventions of the 20th century. Now, sir, I've got a whole bunch of more things to say, but I'll stop. What do you say to that? Lies, lies, and more lies. Well, the interesting thing is, maybe in the olden days, you could get away with making statements that, but you, if you want to check me, you 5 minutes after this meeting is over, you can sit and you can Google the GDP of Japan, the GDP of Germany, the GDP of the United States, blah, 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 and you can find out if what I just said was true or not. I don't have some secret library that I get this. This is the truth. We're producing one-third of the world's wealth. So does productivity make a difference? Yes. Number five, globalization. Win-win, mutual gains from voluntary exchange. Economic growth and trade, specialization, win-win, mutual gains from voluntary exchange. How does it work today? It works today with Nebraska loading up the ships with corn, wheat, and processed beef, and putting on a ship in the Pacific Ocean and sail that sucker out there. And those ships, off they go into the sunset. 3 months later, they come loaded with corn, grain, and processed meat. They come back loaded with Toyotas. That's how trade works. Mutual gains from voluntary exchange. Win, win. It's been the secret of America from the beginning. Michigan could wake up one day and say, we're sick and tired of importing oranges from California. All those fruits and nuts, that's ridiculous. We're going to grow our own oranges in Michigan. Michigan, go ahead. Grow your own oranges. You can do it. Put it under greenhouses. It'll cost you $10 an orange. Do it. No. Michigan does what it does best. California does what it does best. Trade, mutual gains, win-win. That's what globalization is all about, ladies and gentlemen. The world would sometimes go for a century with just 1% rate of growth. A century, 100 years with 1% rate of growth. The last 5 years, the world has been growing at 5% rates of growth each year. This is unheard of. What is going on? What is going on is every country is figuring out that any country can choose prosperity if it wants to. It can choose rule of law. It can choose deregulation. It can choose lower marginal tax rates. It can choose to stabilize the currency. It can choose free trade and to lower tariffs. And it can choose to become amenable to foreign investment. When Slovakia went to a 15% flat tax, when Slovakia deregulated, when Slovakia stabilized their currency, in the meantime, Romania didn't. Romania didn't start this till the last 8 years. But Slovakia's been doing it. All of a sudden, Slovakia's attracting American foreign investment. Slovakia's attracting growth. Here's a little country of 5 million people compared to Romania of 22 million people. And miracles are happening in Slovakia and in Hungary and other places. Well, now Romania has got on the bus because in the last 8 years, they've lowered their marginal tax rate from 80 to 15%. They've lowered tariffs from 22 to 5%. They've deregulated their economy. They're beginning to privatize their economy. Once again, any country can choose prosperity if it wants to. But you have to do a few right things. And we're mentioning those right things in this speech. So globalization, a big deal, and a huge win for Nebraska. A huge win. The golden age of American agriculture is in front of us, not behind us. When Taiwan and South Korea were third world countries without any economic growth, who cared? But when Taiwan and South Korea began to grow economically, guess who ranks as our number 5 and our number 7 agricultural export countries? You got it, Taiwan, South Korea. Win-win, mutual gains from voluntary exchange, once again, to make the point, as far as globalization, the golden age of American agriculture is in front of us. We are some of the greatest producers of protein in the entire world. And you look at Japan, an island country. You look at 1.3 billion people in China, and they're growing. I mean, everybody needs food, and even more important, they want calories, and even more important than that, they want protein. And we are some of the best in the world. So it's a very, very interesting process to watch all this unfold globalization. Point number 6, entrepreneurship. Americans have entrepreneurship in their DNA. Friends, at 18 years old, here's an 18-year-old Romanian. Speaks 3 languages, unbelievably well educated, and can do differential calculus. Here's an 18-year-old American kid. Can barely speak one language, doesn't speak it well, and doesn't even know how to spell differential calculus. So you would say, whoa, whoa, whoa. So at age 18, we don't stand a chance. But then at age 28, here's the American student, here's the 28-year-old Romanian. They don't have an ounce of entrepreneurial blood in their bodies. Most of these bright, bright kids wouldn't know how to open up a lemonade stand if they had to. Whereas your kids and my grandkids, I mean, this is easy. They know how to run a lemonade stand, and they can make money doing it. I was getting out of an airplane a year ago speaking in San Antonio, Texas, to the Texas Bankers Association. I get in the back in San Antonio to go down to the Hyatt Regency in the back of a Checkers yellow cab. In the back of the cab, a flat-screen television. I'm watching this, pictures of the Rocky Mountains, pictures of the Grand Canyon, summer, winter, spring, and fall, pictures of the Smokies, music being piped into this cab like you can't believe. I'm locked in. Sir, yes, yes, we're here. Where? We're here at the hotel. You told me to come to the hotel. Let's go back to the airport. I don't want to miss this. I get out of the cab. I gave him a $17, was the cab ride. I gave him a $20 tip. I handed him $37. And I said, I'm tipping you $20 because I want you to answer this question. Question, is that $20 tip low, medium, or high? He says, sir, that's exactly average. Almost everybody tips me $20. But sometimes I'll have a man sit here and just peel out $100 bills. He says, sir, I am becoming a millionaire. A taxi cab driver! His name is Benito Padilla. I says, Benito, can you be here at this hotel tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock? Because I'm going to share with the Texas Bankers Association what I think the bank of the 21st century is going to look like. And so when I start talking about this, this, and this, that's going to be your cue. I want you to come up, and I want you to tell your story of how you got the idea of putting in a flat-screen television and deciding that a trip, a taxi cab drive, is more than a trip from point A to point B. It can be made into an experience. It can be made into an experience. And if you really make it into a nice experience, people can't peel the money out of their billfolds fast enough. So Benito Padilla came up on the stage with me. He gave his little 3-minute talk. The bankers all stood up, just about the size of this one, about 700 Texas bankers, gave him a standing ovation, and he says, and besides all of that, I'm going to become a millionaire, at which time business cards were coming from everywhere. That is America. That is America. I was having my shoe shined in Pittsburgh. I waited in line. It's lucky I had time between airplanes. Finally, it's my turn. I get up. He slaps the stuff on your shoes. He lights your shoes on fire. The fire goes up. The fire goes out. Gets out of buffer. Buff, buff, bam, bam. $5 every 2 minutes. I timed out. I watched him for 20 minutes. Every 2 minutes, five. Every 2 minutes, $5. $5. I said, sir, I'm an economist. We ask personal questions. You don't have to answer this question if you don't want to. How much money do you make shiny shoes here in Pittsburgh? And he says, this year I'm going to make way more than $50,000 tax-free. entrepreneurship. It's in our veins, and we're now moving to a world where it's all about innovation. We're moving to a world where it's all about ideas. We're moving to a world where machines work, people think, and it's pretty marvelous. It's pretty marvelous. I'm going to look at my watch. Oh, good night. We're already 10 minutes late. Okay, I need three more minutes, maybe three and a half. Okay. Sorry. Okay, those are the six unstoppable trends. As I bring this to a close, we're living in a fast world. Technology can move at the speed of light. You can't. Computers can move 24 hours a day. You can't. Unless you and I strategically act to strengthen ourselves spiritually, physically, we're going to be roadkill on the information highway. What am I saying? Let's pay attention to what comes out of your mouth and mine. What's important? Faith, family, work. Without faith, there's no redemption. Without family, there's no love. Without work, there's no bread on the table. Let's make sure we pay attention. For my wife and I, faith is not everything. It just ranks right up there with oxygen. When it comes to family and love, we now have three grandchildren, age 9, boy, 7, boy, 4-year-old girl. If you'd have told me that Mandy and I, in our fifth decade of marriage, would have the most exciting decade of our marriage, I would not have believed that in a million years, but I don't know what there is about it, but you love your grandkids even more than you love your own kids. I don't understand it, but it's the truth. It's the truth. When Reagan, the 7-year-old, slept, good name, huh? When Reagan slept at our house and I was going out in a suit, he comes running down the hall and says, Papa, I wanted to shower with you. Go back to the bedroom. Take all my clothes off. Get in the shower. We're in there. I'm tall. He's short. I sit my big butt down on the drain. And we're in there with ducks and soap. And we're boxing each other. And I'm thinking, if life can be more fun than this, I don't know how it could possibly be. And so those of you that are not in your fifth decade of marriage, but it's just the first decade or the second or wherever you are, and let's say there's a little rocky time right now, join the club. Male and female, one roof. Come on. So I'm going to just ask you to keep on keeping on. It's worth it. Let me give you one economic statistic. 25% of men kiss their wives goodbye as they leave the house. But 95% of men kiss their houses goodbye when they leave their wives. So it's true. Thank you. So, faith, family, work. All we ask in work, be proactive. Not to act is to act. Not to decide is to decide. Even a mosquito doesn't wait for an opening. He makes one. And be like that guy who walked in the trophy shop. Never been in a trophy shop before. He looks around and he says, gosh, this guy is good. That's Omaha, friends. That's Omaha. And I'll close with, in 1986... Lee Iacocca wrote my office and asked me to be part of the rededication ceremony of the Statue of Liberty on July 4th of 1986. And we rededicated the new Statue of Liberty at Ellis Island, of which all four of my grandparents came to Ellis Island 100 years ago. And so I delivered this, what I'm going to do now. And if you would like to get it, come into my website, barryasmus.com, www.barryasmus.com. Easy website, barryasmus.com. And it's called A Tribute to America. And I would be delighted if you hit that website, and I'd be delighted if you popped off A Tribute to America and showed it to your children or to your grandchildren. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is the United States of America. I was born on July 4th, 1776, conceived in freedom and liberty, and that freedom has brought millions to my shores to cast their economic plight with me. But that freedom has not been cheap. 1 million of my sons have lost their lives in the battlefields of Europe and in Asia. Countless families have cried in anguish as they've heard of the loss of a father, son, a brother, a husband, a sister, a brother, but thank God those lives stood for something. I am big from the Atlantic to the Pacific, to the northern reaches of Alaska, to the beautiful Hawaiian Islands. I have 3.5 million square miles, just teeming with economic opportunity and excitement. I have forests in Oregon, wheat fields in Kansas, oil in Texas, coal in West Virginia. I am the Empire State Building in New York City, the Sears Tower, Chicago, Disneyland. In Southern California, I have 2.5 million farms that are unequal in productivity on any place on the face of this earth. But my story is way more than productive farms and beautiful cities and beautiful places to go. It's mainly the story about people. In America, everybody belongs and everybody deserves a chance. From day one, I've accepted legal immigrants from every country in the world as constitutional equals. To be a Russian, you have to be born Russian. To be a German, you have to be born German. But to be an American, you only have to say, I desire to be an American. America has always been the country where people go to when fleeing from in hope or hopelessness somewhere else. Indeed, I am about people. George Washington was my sword. Patrick Henry was my tongue. John Adams and James Madison were my constitutionalists. And Thomas Jefferson was my pen. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among those are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Endowed by our creator. Not endowed by government, not endowed by politics, not endowed by the military, not endowed by wealth, not endowed by education. No, no, no. Endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights. And the world would never be the same again because of that declaration, creating incredible amounts of wealth and incredible amounts of freedom. But my story is way more than that. It's also a story of power that goes out to defend and not to conquer, a country that goes out to protect and not to possess. When I see a defeated enemy, I bind its wounds, I feed its people, I give it billions and billions of dollars to restore itself to a place of honor among the nations of the world. A country's character, after all, is determined by the sum of its splendid deeds. I've lifted countless people out of poverty. I've abolished slavery. I've instituted more humanitarian programs than all the rest of the countries of the world put together. Now, if you compare that record with the actual histories of both ancient and contemporary societies, America might not be the best conceivable society, but it just might be the best society that's ever existed on the planet. And just to make sure that our walk conforms to our talk, 150 years ago, I had to fight a civil war. In that civil war, 650,000 men were killed. Imagine the sadness of President Lincoln as he comes to the edge of the Gettysburg battlefield in the middle of the Civil War. The year was 1863. 50,000 men had fallen in that battlefield in just 3 days. 50,000 in Lincoln's own life was being cut in half. His country was being cut in half. Can you imagine the sadness of this moment of standing at this battlefield? He gives the Gettysburg Address. It lasts 2.5 minutes. It's less than 700 words long and not a sound, not a sound. He finishes the speech, and President Lincoln said, I finished the speech and I knew that I'd given the worst speech in the history of the world. And a man comes up to him and says, Mr. President, can a nation of the people, by the people, and for the people survive? And Abraham Lincoln answered, I don't know how history is going to speak on America, but I do know that Americans were born to be free. Omaha, thank you for this invitation.
You've been listening to a program from the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce. We've heard the keynote address given at the Chamber of Commerce's 2007 Economic Outlook Luncheon. The guest speaker was Barry Asmus, senior economist at the National Center for Policy Analysis. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Tuesday, November 20th, 2007, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Jane McCain, Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce Special Events Coordinator, for her help in making the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Coate, thanking you for listening.